Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. My question I want to start today's show with, how do artists create something from nothing? How do you define creativity? What is art, discipline, craft? Well, my first guest today set about to find that out. He's made a fascinating series that has aired on PBS. It's called The Artist Toolbox. He's joining me in just one moment. I'll be talking around 12:40 with best-selling author Douglas Preston. He's a prolific writer and half of the writing duo Lincoln and Preston, and they have a new book out called Gideon's Sword. And I'll also talk with Tessa Smith-McGovern about the application that she created for short story readers and short story writers. First, I'm very pleased to welcome John Jacobson to the show. He is the director and host of The Artist Toolbox, aired on PBS. He's also produced feature films and numerous award-winning shorts and is partner in the production company Moga Jacobson. He's a screenwriter. He teaches writing and directing around the country, and he's joining us now. John Jacobson, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you here. Hopefully we are going to stay connected here. We had a little technical difficulty connecting, so I just want to put that out there in case we have any glitches here. But John, you've got such this. First of all, congratulations on this series. It is so fascinating. I just was really compelled watching this and found it very inspiring. But I wanted to start off with just a little of your background, because I think that itself is very interesting. And you've directed over 30 plays. You've assisted legendary Broadway director Hal Prince. You've worked under the Academy Award-winning documentary maker Charles Guggenheim. I read that your father asked you what you wanted to do when you were a kid, and you said be a yachtsman. So how did all this evolve for you? Where did you get started?
Well, I'm not sure the yachtsman story is true. I might have said it as a joke.
Oh.
Well, you know, I was really lucky. I'm just blessed because I was brought up by my parents in Washington, D.C., and my dad is still one of the great modern architects working in this country, Hugh Newell Jacobson. He's on our show, actually, because nepotism begins at home. But his table was always full of the most interesting artists from all across the country that might be coming through D.C. during the 60s and 70s. And I just grew up with just incredible conversation at the table. And so I've been in the theater ever since I was young, and directing and writing and, you know, trying to struggle and do my best. And when we formed this company, Greg Moga, my partner, and I had this idea that maybe PBS is sort of falling behind on holding the mantle of the arts in our country, that we just weren't seeing as much art anymore up there. And we missed that. And it occurred to us that maybe we should start talking to artists, since they're the most fascinating people. You know, artists have all faced adversity, and they've overcome huge challenges to create things that move us all. And they live these lives quite often of bliss because they follow their heart. And I just thought that was a worthwhile dialogue to have.
Yeah, and you picked out, I think it was 13 artists for your first series. I know you're filming your second series now. How did you choose the people that you talked with?
Well, you know, our first series was sort of like, can we make this happen, to be honest? And Greg and I were, Tom Skerritt is a partner of mine at the film school. I'm the executive director there, and he agreed to do it. And that sort of allowed us to make a pilot and then go out and raise some interest and some money to do the next three. And those next three were all people that I could get to or that I knew. And so in the beginning, it was, who do we know that met our standard? And our standard for the show is sort of masters of their craft, leaders in their field. They may not always be household names, like some of our guests, John Legend, Jason Alexander, Isabel Allende, perhaps. But they have to be masters. Everybody in their field will recognize that they're leaders and the best of the best. And so one connection would lead to another, and once artists started to see that this is the only show on television that gave a half hour to one artist to talk about the process of creation, they all started recommending other people, and the season sort of grew from there. And then our other sort of rule as we design the first season towards the end, and now we go into our second, is we want as much diversity as possible. Diversity in art. You know, artists to us are anybody that creates something from nothing using aesthetic value. So we wanted that. We wanted diversity in geography, in race, in gender, as much as we can. This country is so rich in arts, and we just want to expose that.
Yeah, and you talked with people, you talked with chefs, with ballet dancers, with designers, artists, musicians. You really did, as you said, run the gamut there. We're going to take a quick break in just a short moment, and we'll be right back talking with John Jacobson. Great series. It's called The Artist Toolbox, and you can find it on PBS if you do a search there. And we're going to continue talking in a minute. I want to ask John what he learned about this, about himself, when he was doing these interviews. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
1851, Toulouse-Lautrec, 1864 to 1901, Andy Warhol, 1928 to 1987, R.I.P. Ernest Hemingway, 1899 to 1961.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Vicki talks with urological surgeon Dr. Philippa Cheatham about what you and the men you love need to know about prostate cancer. Join us March 14th at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And see more at conversationslive.net.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Beginning March 12th, the American Jewish Committee presents the 16th Annual Seattle Jewish Film Festival, building bridges of mutual understanding through cinema and dialogue. The festival features independent Jewish-themed and Israeli films, special events, guest artists, and educational programs. Starts Saturday, March 12th through 20th. For information, visit seattlejewishfilmfestival.org.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
News, traffic, and weather? Now you can get your information fixed weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
1840 to 1926. Beethoven, Bach, Brahms, Elvis Presley, 1935 to 77. Man Ray, Johnny Ray, John Donne, 1573 to 1631.
And welcome back, everyone. We're talking in this segment with John Jacobson. He's the director and host of The Artist Toolbox, a series that has aired on PBS. It helps us see the beauty in our world by giving us an inside look at what drives artists to create, whether they're musicians, writers, dancers, painters, designers, or actors. John, I said to you at the break, you looked as though you had fun while you were doing this, and you said, how could you not? Tell me what the experience was like for you. Did you learn a lot about creativity for yourself and how you apply that to your work?
Well, when you're in the room with such great artists, you always sort of walk away quite humbled, not because necessarily they're so much more talented than myself, they are. But you know what really it is, and you hear this from show to show, and it's why I think the show is so inspiring, is you realize these people have the courage of their convictions. And that's always a battle for me, is can I really do this? Can I really make a go of that? Do I really think I'm that good? All those insecurities. And these people just, whether they're insecure or not, they just went ahead full steam and just did it. And I admire that so much.
Yeah. And in that vein, two of my favorites were the husband and wife duo you talked to, Isabel and Ruben Toledo. First of all, I wanted to go live in their loft. I mean, that was stunning.
Yeah.
But they stressed this a lot. You asked them what art was, what creativity was, and it was a very nebulous thing for them. It was more of a feeling, more of a spirit. I wonder if you talk about that a little.
Well, I'll try to ask those similar questions to all our artists, because the answers are usually so fascinating. Sometimes the artists have very clear ideas of what it is. Sometimes, like the Toledos, it's so emotionally based, and they may never have ever even thought of what the real definition of what makes art is. So that's going to be a very interesting topic. But I think it's also interesting for all of us to sort of explore that. You know, I sort of believe that whether we make our living as artists or not, all of us have an artist inside trying to express something, trying to come out. And so it's fun to explore with these artists, you know, what gave them permission to let it out, how they get that courage, and then how do they do it on a daily basis.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, many of them, and Isabel and Ruben in particular, said that they did not set out to become what they're doing now. They set out to live with passion and do things that they enjoyed, and this whole career evolved around that. Did you find that consistently with everyone? I haven't seen every single interview, unfortunately, but the ones I did, that seemed to be a fairly common theme.
Well, yeah, you do hear that. And, you know, you said people, just to make a correction, can go up to PBS and find our schedule. That's actually sort of hard. Go up to our website at theartisttoolbox.com and type in your zip code, and it will show where the show's playing, just to get that out there quickly.
Sure.
And you can see all the artists we have on the web that way as well. You know, artists, well, it'd be true if we talk to CEOs, though, I think. No one can see their destiny. No one can see where they're going. And so, but I think what artists do is they're driven to follow their heart. And that's very hard to do because we're all being pulled to go get a job. We're all being pulled to be responsible, to pay our bills. And I said to Ruben Toledo, you probably heard, I said, well, some parents would tell their kids, yeah, you might have the passion, but you might not make a living. And Ruben's response was, they're right to be worried.
Right.
There's no guarantees in life. But, you know, as I counsel my writing students, it's like, what kind of life do you want to live? A life where you were afraid to try to do something that you really, truly wanted to do, and you made, you know, a bundle of money, or that you gave yourself permission to live the life that is yours, the life that you dream of, and you made a bundle of money. What sounds more appealing?
Yeah.
I think the latter.
Yeah. And you said that there is a common thread that you discovered during the interviews. In an article I read about this, you said it was hard work, it was craft and passion. I wonder if you'd talk about a little of each of those and what you learned from talking with these folks.
Well, that's a great springboard from the previous question, because you and I can have as much passion as we want, but if we do not work hard, I mean daily, every day, 24/7 hard, not only at the art part of it, but on the marketing, on the meeting of people part, on the theory part, and we don't have craft, if we have no skill, no real craft, the passion won't take us anyplace. You need a mixture of all three of those to deliver the product. And so you hear that from every one of our artists, that they, like the ballerinas, we talked to the lead dancers of the American Ballet Theater, Arina Beloskarovsky and Maxime Dvorchenko, and they both, you know, were trained in Russia from the age of 6 all the way through 12, just daily, 8 hours a day at ballet, until they finally mastered that craft, which then freed them to follow their heart.
Yeah. Did you have a particular favorite story when you were interviewing these people?
Well, that's hard because every artist is so different, so unique, and they're all so inspirational that you have beautiful, beautiful stories. You know, for me to find any of those stories. One in particular is, you know, my father is such an inspirational man and one big reason I've stayed in the arts probably. And he loved doing what he did so much. And, you know, he has this great story where he went to Yale Architecture School and they taught him all that heart and all that passion. But when he got out, I was his oldest child, so I was there at the beginning of his career, and I remember seeing him in the basement, and he was just having the hardest time on his first commission, and he called up Lou Kahn, who was his mentor, and he said, Lou, I don't know if this building's going to stand up. And Lou Kahn said, okay, I want you to go to the hardware store, and I want you to buy a chicken coop. Build it. And I remember seeing my dad, you know, probably in his early 30s, on the ground, cursing as he put together the chicken coop. But the reason Lou Kahn had him do that was to prove to him how buildings bore weight, how they actually stood up to get it out of design and theory and get it into practice. And from that, my father learned, you know, oh, that's how that building is going to support the rest of the building.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. And he taught you also that God is in the details, especially so if you're building buildings, I would imagine.
Well, all art, God is in the details. And that's a very hard thing to teach because when you're a young artist, you don't know the details yet. You don't know how specific you have to get yet. But you learn with time that the writer learns that one word is better than three words, that this little paint adjustment is better than not paying attention to the paint adjustment. You know, God is in the details for sure.
Yeah. I was interested with Daniel, Chef Daniel Balud. He said that he's not just a chef, though. He's a whole industry, isn't he?
Yeah, he owns, I think, 20 restaurants across the world.
What did you take away from him? What was the key takeaway from your discussion with him? And I think you spent like 6 or 7 hours with each of the people you talked with.
Yes, we did. And generally, we go to their location. They don't come to us. You know, like the great interview show, Charlie Rose, they come to his studio and he does them for an hour there. But we go to their house, their place of work, their studio, their restaurant.
And that's what makes it so appealing.
I hope so. I mean, that was my idea, is that, you know, it's fascinating talking to these people, but it's also fascinating watching them do the process of their art. So painters painting, ballet dancers practicing. How do they do it? David Garrett, the violinist, working with his team on the music and how to compose a song. I just find it fascinating to be in the room with these geniuses, and we're so rarely invited into there, so I'm hoping that makes the show even more special. You know, Daniel Ballou is just has a passion for people. He loves people, and he also loves the finest details. God is in the details. He loves the perfect ingredients, and all his food, when you look at that plate, is so beautifully presented. It is art from the day it comes into his hands to the time it goes into your mouth.
Yeah, and you talked of, you know, because it's his name at the front here, but it took a whole bunch of people behind his name to put that food to your table.
Well, you know, we shot there all day with him in this huge blizzard in New York, and we shot in his restaurant, Danielle, which has this incredible kitchen. No joke, I mean, he has like 8 highly trained chefs, all of which could work at other restaurants, working within his kitchen, plus 20 other people. It's that big. And the beautiful part is he has this room above the kitchen that's a full wall of glass, and he sat my wife, Tia, up there while I was filming and interviewing him down in the while he was cooking with all those chefs. And Pia was just fed the most special food. It's like being in a yacht. And she got to watch all that action, and the waiters coming in from the beautiful, elegant Danielle restaurant, coming in, calling their orders in. You get to see the whole military precision of that operation. It's really spectacular.
Yeah, so great collaboration. And that was evident also when you talked with the husband and wife team we just talked about, Isabel and her husband, because she's a fashion designer, but she doesn't sketch, so he does the sketches for her.
Isn't that unique? She doesn't really paint or draw. She just talks out her ideas. Like, I see the shoulder looking like this, maybe out of crepe, and then he sketches that. Is that like what you're seeing? And then she goes, yes, no, more like this. And they come up with these beautiful drawings that she then takes down to her seamstresses and says, make that.
Yeah, it was fascinating. They also talked about discipline and spontaneity being necessary, but you kind of think of those two things as being opposite. What did you take away about discipline and spontaneity and how they work in creativity?
Your question is so good. I teach a lot of acting, and I'm a theater director from background. I love to teach. And when you work with actors, a lot of young actors come in and think that acting is nothing but spontaneously being the character, like, I feel like this, I feel happy, I feel this. But the truth is almost the opposite, is that you need great discipline to learn the craft and how to build a character and how to build a moment, how to analyze your material, to make decisions. And once you get good at that craft, which takes a lot of discipline, then that frees you to be in the moment, to be spontaneous. But if you and I did a scene right now, we would only be spontaneous as Vicky and John. We wouldn't be spontaneous as Willie Loman and his wife, because we don't know those characters. You have to do a tremendous amount of preparation in order for spontaneity to even appear to have any reality.
Interesting. Now, also, I one of the comments that I found interesting was you asked, how do you develop style? And one of the answers was by our mistakes, through our mistakes. That's how we develop our own style. I wonder if you'd talk about that for a little.
Well, all of us, I mean, who is born, well, I guess some people are born truly geniuses, but most of us bumble through finding what our style is and finding what we like and finding what sells and finding what other people like. And you know, I'm saying to writers all the time that I work with, you need to get the critic out of your life, because that critic is keeping you from writing. And I think that's true with all art. It does take a little arrogance, doesn't it, to be an artist? Because you have to sort of believe that you can make a movie when no one else thinks you can, or you can sell a painting when everybody else is saying artists make no money. It takes a little overbelief in yourself to see you through those hard times. But artists can't have a critic sitting in their own head saying your work stinks, because it'll just stop you from producing anything.
Right, right. How do you teach people, John, to develop and trust their instinct?
By lots of support and lots of nurturing. At least that's my approach. And you know, I always say to my young students, and young can be all the way up to 75 years old, I suppose, but, you know, beginning students, that if anybody's in your life being negative and saying you can't do something, you don't want to talk to that person much more, because I don't believe it. I think we can do anything we want. And you need to have a total positive outlook, a belief that you can do something, and wholly pursue that heart. Pursue what your heart is telling you to do. It's not going to come easy. You got to work hard.
Right. Ruben Toledo, I believe, said that we all live a life of passion, whether we know it or not. We live a passionate life to the extent that we can let ourselves. It's a kind of fearlessness. How do you determine passion and living with passion?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure everybody lives that life. I wish I could say they do, but I think a lot of people have that passion buried deep inside of them as they struggle to go about doing what they think they're supposed to be doing. You know, so, you know, for me, that passion is in the little moments of life. You know, it's rarely in the big moments. It's usually, and it's going to sound cliche, but it's usually in the little hug from your child, or the little toe of the child, or the little smile, or the beautiful sunny moment. I mean, those are the things when I can enjoy my life and enjoy those little things, I realize how lucky I really am. And that's my passion.
Mm. And I know, obviously, you're passionate about the arts. We've talked about that, and television being a great forum for them. What would you like to see happening on television as far as arts?
Well, you know, television is the greatest forum. I mean, it's the real main media of our time, and unfortunately, books aren't anymore. And television is just chucking that mantle right out the window with every reality show and violent show, and local news is just horrendous now with what they choose to report. You know, I said this to another interviewer the other day. You and I and all these interviewers and everybody that puts things on TV and artists, we have a responsibility. We have a responsibility to improve the world around us, not just to entertain. Yeah, that's part of it, but to improve it, to teach people there's a better way to do things. And that's what I would wish television producers, idealistically, I admit, would embrace.
Right.
How do you make this better?
Right. So can you give us a little insight into what's coming up in the next series?
Sure. Well, you know, we learned a lot from the first series, although we did a lot of things right as well. And what we're hoping to do is show more process, just as much diversity and more diversity, of course. And we have people like Helen Mirren, Angela Lansbury, the great cartoonist, Jules Pfeiffer, the great jazz composer, Dave Brubeck, the wonderful photographer, Sally Mann, Bon Jovi, more, I'm sure. Oh, Annie Coates, the great editor, film editor, who won an Academy Award for Lawrence of Arabia and has cut so many major movies since then. She's just brilliant. So we're trying to get that mixture of big names as well as maybe some artists that people don't know that we think are brilliant also, and try to make that sort of the hallmark of the show, that we're always going to introduce you to masters of their class. Jeff Leatham, who's the greatest floral designer, who did Chelsea Clinton's wedding and does the Georges V in Paris. Sylvia Weinstock, who I think is the greatest cake designer in New York, is just unbelievable. Try to bring them on the show as well.
Wow. I'm looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to seeing the ones that I didn't manage to catch this time around. The Artist Toolbox is the series. John, where can people find out more information about you and your work?
Thank you for asking. Go up to the website, www.theartisttoolbox.com, and certainly my bio's up there, but all our artists, we have one-minute promos of each of the artists, plus back behind-the-scenes promos, and then you can see, if you type in your zip code, you can see where it's playing around the country.
Fabulous. I really appreciate you being with us today. I really can't recommend this series high enough. I thoroughly enjoyed it. In fact, I watched the one with Isabel and Ruben about three times. So.
Yeah, wonderful. And that's playing again. PBS is going to re-air all our first season again and again throughout this year.
Yeah. Okay, great. Good to know. And the website one more time, please.
TheArtistToolbox.com, and people can buy DVDs of any of the episodes up there as well.
Super. Thank you so much. My guest, John Jacobson, his series, TheArtistToolbox.com. Please do stay with us when we come back. We'll talk with Tessa Smith-McGovern. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Have you heard about the painter Vincent van Gogh, who loved color and who let it show? Now in the museum, what have we here? The baddest painter since God's Jan Vermeer, and he loved...
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time. Intuitive dream coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com, and if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce@joycechapman.com.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Like what you hear? Be sure and support the sponsors who support your favorite programs on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My next guest is Tessa Smith McGovern, and we're talking about creativity today. And she has created an app for your phone where you can listen to short stories. But let me bring Tessa on. We'll find a little bit more about her because I know she is an award-winning writer herself. Tessa, welcome.
Thanks very much, Vicky. Thanks for inviting me.
And a fellow Brit. We were just chatting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're calling us from Connecticut today, but you've lived in the States for 19 years. I know that. Mm-hmm. And so tell us a little bit about the work that you do as a writer.
Well, I'm a short story writer. I first published in 96, so I've been writing for a long time. And I was always writing a novel, and I never finished them to my satisfaction. I always, you know, I've got drawers full of them. And then the market crashed in 2008, and so I gave it up. I said, you know, this is obviously not meant to be for me. And I was looking at my iPhone one day, and it just hit me that it would be fantastic to have photographs of London. I'm sure you know how this feels. Sometimes you just get home, you get homesick, and it's such a treat to have these photographs and write about the places that I used to live. And I thought it would be great to have those to transport the reader right to the place and then have the story uninterrupted to be able to read for themselves.
Yeah. Now, you're an award-winning writer yourself. You know, as do many other short story writers out there, I'm sure, that it's kind of hard to find markets for short stories.
It definitely is, except if you're writing fairly dark material, which I did. I had a period where I wrote a lot of very sad stories maybe 10 years ago. There are lots and lots of great literary magazines in the States. That's one thing that's fabulous over here is there are plenty of places to send your work to. They won't pay you, but it will be a clip on your resume. So there is that, but there really isn't a market for well-written short stories, literary short stories that have life-affirming endings. And that was really one thing I wanted to change because I wanted to read them myself when I'm sitting waiting for the kids in the car, you know, and I've got 10 minutes. That's what I wanted to read.
Yeah, you wanted a mini vacation in a day full of stress, right?
I don't know if you have the same feeling, but if the story's good and you sit down and you get lost in it for 10 or 15 minutes, then everything just seems to calm down.
And yes.
It's great.
Yeah. Now, I read that you took the idea of the chapbook for this application that you created, and that came from, I love this, from the latest technology in the 16th century.
I know. It's such a fascinating thing. I see the whole trajectory of story. You know, we were on the cave walls telling stories, then around the fireplace, then the monks would tell the stories, they would write them. And then the Gutenberg Press came along, then everybody had books, then we got televisions, then the internet, and now our stories are going on the internet. And I think what's going to happen is our stories are going to go back up on the wall when we get internet TVs as when they're commonplace. I think it's going to be this circle that will complete.
Right. That's the way life usually goes, isn't it? It usually goes full circle at some point.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So if somebody's a writer of short stories, I read that Ichuk actually does pay for their stories, but I'm assuming there's a submittal and there's an approval kind of process.
There is. You submit directly on our website at ichuk.com, and if anybody would like to read more information, everything is there about the length, which is 750 words to 2,000 words. We like to say that whatever your topic is, we have an app for that because we cover all different types, fiction, nonfiction, memoir, within that length. And really what we're looking for is stories that the writer has felt deeply. We do edit. Our editor is Betty Kelly Sargent, who was the ex-editor-in-chief of William Morrow in New York. And so, you know, it doesn't have to be. We have some in our upcoming app, which is about memoir. We have some New York Times writers, and we have some people publishing for the first time. And so the level of editing has been very different for each of them. Some needed nothing at all, and others needed fairly significant content revision. But if the piece is right, then that's what we're after.
Okay. And so do you get involved in that, or do you have a team of editors working on that? How does that work?
The manuscript goes to, once we've chosen the stories, it's primarily me, but we also we have some readers, and also Leslie Paparo works with me. Once we've chosen the stories, they go to Betty in the city, and she edits them, then they come back to me. And, you know, we don't always agree on every edit, so I do the final sort of check. And I like to hear people's voice. I like to hear sometimes an unusual word. You know, some people don't like that. I actually like to hear the voice of the individual writer
Okay.
come through.
Okay. So short story writers out there, I hope you're paying attention. And I said that this is an application for the phone, but, you know, I'm reading here that you can buy full-color chapbooks online, mm-hmm. as you said, from eChook.com. And eChook is E-C-H-O-O-K, E-C-H-O-O-K.com. On iPads, iPhones, Android phones, iTunes, Kindle, Sony Reader, Kobo, or Nook.
Right.
Where do you see this going? How do you see this developing?
I think where the industry is going in general is that publishers are becoming more and more niche. You know, we're very specific. We're really publishing good quality women's fiction, 10-minute stories you can read in the palm of your hand, stories that are going to make you feel good when you finish them. They may be raw, there may be some dark stuff in there, but they're not going to leave you feeling devastated. So that's what we do, and I think that publishers in general have got to make it very clear in advance what sort of experience the reader is going to have, because we've all got such a deluge of stuff coming at us that I'm not willing to take a chance on a story when I don't know the writer and I don't know where it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that Amazon does a great job of it, you know, with their look inside the book. That's the kind of thing I think that publishers need to make clear to readers in advance.
Very good. Well, we have a gift bag giveaway that Tessa Smith-McGovern is offering to our listeners, and you can enter for that. We're going to do a sweepstakes on that. You can email me at Vicky, V-I-C-K-I, at conversationslive.net. That's Vicky, V-I-C-K-I, at conversationslive.net, and just put Ichuk giveaway in the subject line, and we'll do a drawing for the gift bag giveaway today that comes from Tessa Smith-McGovern and Ichuk. Final word you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Tessa?
I guess I would like to say that a lot of people don't realize that short stories can really be very rewarding. There are classic short shorts by Dostoevsky, Chekhov. Live writers Tobias Wolff has a fabulous short short called Powder, which is actually available online for free. Readers can get it. And you can really have something rewarding and a moving experience with beautiful writing. That's what we're after. And with the London Road short stories, even though each story is self-contained, we follow the characters through each story. So it's not just a story and then you lose the characters. So there is some continuance with it, which I think can be nice.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Tessa. You can find out more again at echook.com. Tessa Smith-McGovern, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Vicky. I appreciate it.
Sure. And please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking with best-selling author Douglas Preston about his new book. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Notice anything different? You should. There's no other station like Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And in this segment, I'm talking with best-selling author Douglas Preston. He is truly a prolific writer, and he's the other half of the writing duo, Lincoln and Preston. I'm going to bring him on right now, and we'll find out more about Douglas Preston and his work. Douglas, welcome.
Good to be on the show.
Well, I'm pleased to have you on the show. My gosh, you certainly have written a lot of books with your partner, your writing partner, Lincoln. I can't even speak right now. You've certainly written a lot of books. A lot of people might wonder how this works together between the two of you writing. I read that you live 500 miles apart, but you do everything with email and fax. And how does it work for you? Obviously pretty well, I would say, judging by the number of books you've written.
Well, it's probably a good thing we live apart. Otherwise, we'd come to fisticuffs at times. we have been writing together for a number of years, and usually the way it works, it can be a rocky situation, but usually how it works is that I'll write a sequence of chapters and send them to Lincoln, and then he will take my Shakespearean-level prose and absolutely butcher it, which will make me furious. And so when I get his chapters, then I have to rewrite them very vigorously, which makes him angry. And we sort of go back and forth like that until the publisher rips the manuscript out of our hands.
So, and this is a brand new series you've written. The first, I know there are more coming down the road, but the first one is called Gideon's Sword. What made you decide to create a new series together?
Well, we had been writing quite a number of books featuring our main character, Pendergast, who's an eccentric FBI agent. But we have a mortal fear of falling into a rut and sort of producing the same sort of thing. So we thought, well, wouldn't it be fun to create a whole new series with a new character, completely different kind of person? And after many long arguments and telephone conversations and email exchanges, we found this character standing in front of us, Gideon Crewe, who was an interesting person. He's a physicist at Los Alamos. I live in New Mexico part of the year, and I know quite a few physicists who work up there. He works on the bomb program. He was in a previous, before he straightened himself out, he was an art thief and has a number of skills left over from that particular profession. And he's just a very interesting character. He's sort of a master of social engineering, which is pretty much a new spin on the old confidence And so Gideon Crewe's a master manipulator. He's an extremely glib, you know, articulate person. His morals are somewhat sketchy, but underneath it all, he does have a good heart.
Now, many writers include little bits of themselves into their some of their characters. Since two of you are writing this, did that happen in this case?
Well, it's funny. You know, there may be bits of us in Gideon Crewe, but I'd put it more like wishful thinking. You know, we wish we were like him. I mean, I wish I was as intelligent as he is, and perhaps wish that I was as good-looking and charming as he is. I wish I were, but so both Lincoln and I think have put not only parts of ourselves, but parts of our wishful thinking into him as well.
Mm.
And then there are other things that I'm very glad I'm not. You know, I think my moral character is much higher than Gideon's, but, that's, you know, part of who he is.
Right. Your publicist actually envisions him like Daniel Craig, the new James Bond. So I guess that's a compliment to you guys.
Well, I you know, it's funny. I don't see him myself as being like James Bond, because James Bond is a man who always seems to be in control and has the right response to everyone and, you know, dresses beautifully, mm-hmm. and his martinis are always perfectly mixed. Whereas Gideon Crewe is a bit of a bumbler. Although he's highly intelligent, he makes mistakes. He's weak at times. He has a weakness for alcohol. He gets himself involved with women in the most unfortunate way. He's more...
It's more human. More human.
Yes, he's a lot more human. He's a lot more frail.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think that he's got a bigger heart than James Bond. I think James Bond always struck me as being a bit of a cold person.
Mm. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with Douglas Preston. He is a co-author of Gideon's Sword, along with Lincoln Child. They've written a ton of books together, and this is a brand new series, Gideon's Sword. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Vicky talks with urological surgeon Dr. Philippa Cheatham about what you and the men you love need to know about prostate cancer. Join us March 14th at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and see more at conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
You're listening to the refreshingly different Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Douglas Preston. He co-authors books with Lincoln Child. I was just chatting in the break, and he said about 25. He's lost count, but it's a lot. But this is a brand new series. It's called Gideon's Sword, and the main protagonist is Gideon Crewe. How did you get started writing, Douglas?
Well, I started off as what I call a, quote, serious writer. I wrote nonfiction books, mostly about history and exploration. I wrote for the New Yorker magazine. But one day I was approached by an editor at St. Martin's Press to do a nonfiction book about the Museum of Natural History in New York, where I worked. And that editor was Lincoln Child. And I published that book. It was called Dinosaurs in the Attic. It was a nonfiction book about the museum. But Lincoln insisted on getting a tour of the weird areas of the museum, the storage rooms and so forth, where there's stuff that the public never sees. So I gave him a tour rather late at night, because I didn't want to get caught with an unauthorized person. And at the end of the tour, he turned to me and he said, "Doug, you know, this is incredible. Nobody knows about this. This place, this museum, would make the most fantastic setting for a thriller." And I said, "Oh, Lincoln, I'm not a thriller writer." He said, "Come on, Doug, we'll write it together. It'll be fun." So we did. We wrote it. It became The Relic, which is a very successful book. It was made into a marvelously campy horror film by Paramount Pictures. And I found that I really loved writing these books with him. We have so much fun. And they're, you know, we are great believers in a story. You know, the stories are fast, they have a lot of action. I think that our characters are good. I think that these are really fun books to read.
Yeah. I think that's what we've lost a lot from our films today is the art of storytelling. You know, we get sometimes lost in techniques and technologies and, you know, everybody's so wowed by special effects. But if there's no story there, for me, it's not worth dealing with.
Well, all the great, I think, the great works of literature were thrillers. I mean, Hamlet is a thriller of a kind. I mean, Gilgamesh. The Iliad and the Odyssey. I mean, these are books that tell wonderful, wonderful stories. And I think you're right. I think we have, to a certain extent, not everyone. I mean, there are many wonderful books being written that aren't thrillers as well. But I think there are some books that where the technique, the preciousness of them, the story gets lost.
Hmm. Now, I know you write full-time, but does Lincoln write full-time? Does he do something else? I'm assuming this absorbs pretty much most of his time, too.
Well, we do write full-time. I mean, we also write novels on our own, solo novels from time to time. And then we do these books together. But we both are now writing full-time. I mean, we did, when we started out, we had to obviously have remunerative jobs because, you know, you can't make a living writing right off the bat.
Right.
So we'd write in the evenings and on weekends. But then when our writing reached a certain level, we were able to make a living from it. Then we quit our day jobs and just became writers.
Yeah, 25 plus books later. A lot of today we've talked about creativity. Tell me what creativity means to you, Douglas.
That's a really deep question. I think creativity is the ability to make strange and unusual and surprising connections between completely disparate things. I mean, I know that, like with Gideon's Sword, this new book, the way that came about was I was doing research on Potter's Field. You know, these are the public burial grounds where paupers are buried.
Right.
And I learned that there's an island off the coast of New York City, just in Long Island Sound, part of New York. It's 110 acres, and it is the largest graveyard in the world. It's New York City's Potter's Field. And this really surprised me. And then I learned the island is uninhabited and covered with ruins. It used to be a prison. There used to be an old Nike missile base on the island. I mean, it's just a really picturesque and unusual place. And I thought, wow, what a great setting for a novel. But what will happen on this island? And then as I researched more, I came across an amazing factoid, which I wish I could tell you, but it would ruin the book for all your listeners. But there's something else buried on that island every day by prisoners from Rikers Island, which is a New York City prison, every day that is so bizarre, it's a lot more bizarre than corpses. And when I read that, I called up Lincoln. I said, Lincoln, have we got an idea for a book? And we started talking about it, and pretty soon the whole plot sort of fleshed itself out, and that became Gideon's Sword. So that creative process started with sort of an accident, you know?
Yeah, I think it often does. We talked earlier as well about discipline and spontaneity in the creative process because they seem very opposite, and yet you need both. Talk to me a little bit about discipline and spontaneity from your perspective as an author.
Well, those are two great words that actually encompass or frame what creativity is all about. You know, spontaneity is the ability to keep your mind open and receptive to making these bizarre connections. But the discipline is the part that I think a lot of people lose. And that is, you have got to sit there in front, at least for me, I've got to sit there in front of a computer 8 hours a day, like any bank clerk out there, but disciplining myself and staying with it and writing and keeping going. It's so difficult. Sometimes you want to get up, you want to say, forget it, you know, I'm stuck, walk off. But without the discipline, you don't work through those problems. I mean, I know Hemingway, when he was, even the mornings that he was viciously hungover and could barely stand, he would stand at his desk, because he wrote standing up, gripping the sides of the desk for 4 hours, even though he knew he wasn't going to get a word written, he was determined to be at his writing desk for 4 hours.
Amazing.
And that, you know, that I admire that. That
yeah.
is real discipline.
Yeah. And, you know, we hear a lot about writer's block, artist's block in general, but half of it, I would say probably even three quarters of it, maybe even more, is just getting your butt in the chair or standing in front of the desk. I know that myself.
Well, it's funny because I know of a very famous writer. I won't mention his name, but he used to tie himself into his chair. And I said to him, well, why do you do that? You can always untie yourself. And he said, well, I tied really big knots so that they were hard to untie, and it just stopped me enough from getting up. It prevented me from getting up.
Yeah, I've read all kinds of things about people. I think I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago on the show where there was one famous author who actually took off every stitch of clothing, gave them to his valet, told him to take them away and not bring them back until the end of the day, so he could not go anywhere.
Oh, I love that. What a marvelous story. I love that.
Yeah.
That's good. That's a good one to try.
So do you see film coming from your books?
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because we did actually sell Gideon's Sword to Paramount Pictures. In fact, Paramount bought the entire series. We haven't written any more than one book, but they said they wanted the whole series. They wanted to do a sort of like a James Bourne-like series of films based on Gideon Crew.
So mm-hmm.
We're very excited about that. Obviously, you know, there's a long road to go there. It's not necessarily going to happen, but they, you know, they did sign an option with us, and we're very happy about it.
Very good. Again, earlier we talked about craft. What does craft mean to you, and how important is learning your craft?
Well, I think craft is very important. I mean, first of all, it's shocking to me how many writers just struggle with the actual English language. You know, the grammar, the sentence structure, some of the fundamental elements of the language they have trouble with. It surprises me. And often, you know, Lincoln and I like to use big words in our books, mostly for fun. We love the language itself. And you wouldn't believe how many emails we get from readers. How dare you? I don't know what this word is. Who do you think you are?
Oh, so I think, you know, dictionary?
I know. It is funny. It is funny. I do, you know, Lincoln and I do, we were both English majors. We both studied, you know, English literature. We both love the language. And I really do appreciate books, thrillers or whatever, any kind of book that are written with a love of not only the beauty of the English language, but the funniness of it.
Yes.
Because there's a funniness or a humor in the use of language that I appreciate.
Yeah, we can have a lot of fun with the language. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Douglas. We want to give them your website, but what would you like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I would speaking to your listeners who would like to write, because many people would, those two words you mentioned earlier, discipline and spontaneity, are very important. But I think the word discipline is almost the most important of all. If you can carve out time, sacred time, where you really shoo away all members of your family and they're frightened to even open the door, and you can do that for an hour or two a day, you can be a writer. And it's just like playing the violin. You have to practice and practice and practice, and eventually, if you work hard enough, you might just go to Carnegie Hall.
Yep, learn the craft. And your website, please?
It's www.prestonchild.com. And we also, you can email us from the website, and we actually answer all our emails. At least so far, we're able to. And we're also very active on Facebook. We have a lot of fun posting pictures and interacting with our readers.
Okay. And we can find all of that at PrestonChild.com. Did I get that the right way around? PrestonChild.com.
That's it.
Super. Douglas Preston, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Vicki.
And again, Douglas Preston, the other half of the writing duo, best-selling writing duo, Lincoln Child and Douglas Preston, and the book Gideon's Sword. Before we go today, I want to just remind you that the American Jewish Committee presents the 16th annual Seattle Jewish Film Festival, Building Bridges of Mutual Understanding. It's through cinema and intergroup dialogue, and it features independent Jewish-themed and Israeli films right here in Seattle. Special guests and guest artists and educational programs. You can find out more at SeattleJewishFilmFestival.org. I gotta run. Live well, live strong.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Vicki talks with urological surgeon Dr. Philippa Cheatham about what you and the men you love need to know about prostate cancer. Join us March 14th at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And see more at conversationslive.net.